Thanks, Amit. And thanks so much, David and Heejin, for joining us. I think we're all really excited to hear about your journey. I think most of the people in the service-based ecosystem know of you because of the wonderful video that you made for Service Space. This is the Be Selfish, Be Generous video that I think many of us have seen, and even some of the folks on the call have been on. Your journey actually starts, I think, with design and even technology design, and then has moved towards film and service. And these sorts of transitions are often most interesting in the intention that set them off, and then the edges where they've transitioned from one thing to another. So I wanted to just ask both of you a little bit about your own history and trajectory, starting from design and through technology leading to film and service. How it got started and what were those things that made it evolve from one field to another and continue to make it evolve.
Okay. Good morning. I guess I'll start.
David, can we ask you just to speak up just a little bit? Because I know there were some folks that were having a little bit difficulty hearing everyone.
I'll do my best here. Is that better?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Both Adrian and I started as industrial designers, both industrial designers and architects, and involved in architectural design, I should say, not architects. Came from a design education, both practiced design independently. We didn't know each other when we first started. I graduated from Rhode Island School of Design in Providence and came out to California and went to work for several technology firms, and then landed at Apple Computer. Was there for a couple of years and then joined a company called Frog Design. And again, practiced developing and designing products, which then led to creating my own firm, and did that for probably 10 or 15 years. And gradually we were, I think, asked by one of our clients if we could tell a story about, without getting into the details of it, what the future would look like for this particular company. And that led to making a film for them. And gradually we started to say, you know, storytelling is a really interesting, fun, engaging process. It's not dissimilar from design, but it's a very hands-on, craft-like profession. And that's I think, what drew me initially, and I would guess Heejin would say the same. That, you know, and also I think I was at a somewhat of a crisis point in my design career. I felt like I was making things that were really using up resource and not really delivering much value in the long term, and that was troubling to me. You know, I feel like we've been in a what I would call an accumulation mode in our culture here in America and throughout the world in many places, modern world, and where I feel like we need to move to is a preservation mode in very simple terms. And I felt like playing the role of a designer and working for organizations that make things that, you know, are consumed and are accumulated and then thrown away very quickly really didn't fit. So gradually we moved into this world of storytelling and filmmaking. and it felt like a much better fit in the sense of it was giving back in a different way. It was connecting with people. It was not taking resource, but giving. So that's what sort of led us there. And I don't know, Heejin, maybe you've got some things to share about that.
Well, I have a similar background as David. I came from industrial design. I started with the engineering background and then gradually moved to design. I studied in London, Central St. Martins, and then worked for different consultancies and corporations designing products. And it wasn't satisfying creating products for consumers. It was, as David put it, taking, not giving. So I joined with David in storytelling and found more meaning in life doing this and enjoy doing it still. So.
Thank you. One of the things that I think most stands out about your filmmaking is this very simple, uncluttered aesthetic of your work. And it's such a contrast, I think, to the way that we're used to interacting with media, which tends to be sort of flashy and, you know, consistently trying to draw your attention in a very overt way. And I sense that what has driven that is perhaps what you're mentioning about your insights around consumption and moving to sort of preservation mode instead of eating up resources. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that sort of very clean aesthetic of your work and what's really informed it and what was the process you went through to arrive at that.
Well, I think a couple things. You know, number one, our design education. You know, and that, I mean, most modern design has evolved from what's known as the Bauhaus style, you know, that was sort of the international style that started really in the early 1900s in Germany. And I, without going into a whole dissertation about Bauhaus, you know, if you're interested, I'd encourage you to. There's a great article in Wikipedia. You can type in the Bauhaus German modernism and read about it. But it certainly had an influence on design and design education for the last century. And so that's where I think the beginning of the simplicity begins. And then the other side of that is, you know, the old saying, well, I'm sorry, I didn't have time to write you a short letter. Because refinement and editing and sort of taking things down to the simplest form take time. It's actually harder to do than to write a long letter. You know, I can write a long letter quicker than I can write a short one because I don't have to edit. I don't have to be as careful with my words. I don't have to be, you know, as particular. So for us, I think it's an interesting challenge to reduce things. You know, use sort of reductionist ideas to reduce things to the bare essentials, and to me, and I think Heejin would agree, is there's a certain beauty to that. They're really trying to get things down to the core essence, and I think in the end, when it's delivered to someone, it becomes something that's very easy to take in. and you know, it doesn't necessarily express the work that goes into it. It looks simple, but usually isn't. So that's sort of a short answer to where that inspiration came from. And another place it comes from, I pulled out a quote from Henry David Thoreau. It was actually written on March 27th, 1848, so almost 200 years ago. He writes, "So simplify the problem of life, distinguish the necessary and the real, probe the earth to see where your main roots run. I would stand upon the facts." And so I think he was another inspiration in that he, both in his writing, his work, his philosophy, was really about simplicity. And if you read, Walden Pond or some of his other works, you begin to see an uncluttered life, and he worked very hard at that. So that's the long answer, I guess, to the question of where does it, the uncluttered aesthetic come from.
Yeah. One of the things that I noticed about your process, your filmmaking process, is that it begins with questions. And I guess kind of along the line of what Nipun was suggesting, or saying rather, formulating the right question is what's most essential. So I'm curious about the questions that you ask yourself and ask of your subject as you're arriving at the essence, that uncluttered simplicity that you're trying to bring across. What is it that you, how do you get at the essence of something?
Well, I think in the simplest form, in terms of the answer to that, is by listening. Certainly we work very hard when we develop a set of questions for an interview to get to, we usually start with developing a story. It's like, okay, well, what story do we want to tell about this particular subject or about this particular person or this topic? And we first write usually a short synopsis to say, okay, why are we doing this? It's really a question of why are we interested in this? Why is it important to us? And then from there, developing the questions that we think will bring that story forward. And it's always interesting when you do an interview with someone. Sometimes the answers to the questions aren't what you expect. And I think you also have to be fluid and flexible and kind of let the story go where it goes. So that's something we've learned and we continue to learn as we do these kinds of projects. It's evolving. It's a constant learning process. I don't know. Do you have anything else?
Well, we also never show the questions beforehand to our interviewees to get most spontaneous and honest answers, because usually when you show them questions beforehand, they come rehearsed and a little bit nervous, and I think that helps to get our story most clean and honest as possible.
I'm now thinking about the fact that as I was trying to research questions for you guys, I did send you guys an outline, a sketch of the things I wanted to cover. So forgive me for breaking the process that I think you guys follow in bringing out simplicity and keeping yourself receptive to listening and the spontaneity of people's response. responses. I do know that this sort of value of simplicity has kind of crossed over into your personal lives in a pretty profound way. I think it's Nipun who shared that you guys have distilled your personal belongings down to 600 items, and that is a pretty astounding number. I mean, for a couple, I mean, I know that sometimes I feel like my wife owns at least, 30 pairs of shoes. So it's pretty impressive to bring an aesthetic like that down to the very personal and the way that you decide to live in the world. I wanted to just understand more of your thoughts around what sparked that engagement, that deep personal engagement with simplicity in your own lives, the reasons for it, and the insights that have come out of living with that few number of things. If both of you can speak up a little bit, I think folks on the call are having a little bit of trouble hearing.
We'll try. I have a low voice, so it's hard for me to talk much louder. I'll do my best. The first of all, the number that Nipun gave you is slightly off. We have 937 objects. We have a few more items than that.
Still an impressive number.
Yeah. And also, to be fair, that project or that. Let me back up. Where it started was we were reading a book. It was called, and Heejin always reminds me, I can't remember the name of it. Oh, it's called Hooked. And it's written by, I have it here.
Stephanie Kaza.
And it's Hooked, Buddhist Writings on Greed, Desire, and the Urge to Consume. And it's a series of essays about just that. And the interesting part was I picked up the book and I started reading it, and the introduction was written by our friend Paul Hawken, and he describes his life growing up on a farm, you know, how nothing was ever wasted and how he lived a very simple life, a very simple existence. Not having a lot of money, his family, did their best with what they had, and as I said, nothing was wasted. And he sort of talks about that, and then he gradually moves into a story about a dear friend of his who was a successful business person, had made, a fair amount of money. And when he retired, he decided he was going to get rid of all of his possessions except for the bare essential things that he needed to live. And it came down to about 600 objects. And because what he wanted to do was focus his time on giving back instead of consuming. And both of us were very curious about, how much is 600 items? So we set out to find out. So that's what sort of started this. And what we did is we decided to photograph room by room everything we had. So we took everything out of the cabinets and drawers and room by room methodically photographed. We ended up with a series of 17 pictures that showed everything we owned. And it became an artistic installation, actually, that was shown at the Frost Museum in Miami.
David, this is Amit. I just had a quick question for you. So with limiting, you know, your objects down to 937, again, a very sort of specific number, it kind of, you know, it enables you to really concentrate on what it is that's there before you. So are there any objects that you guys found that is an absolute cannot live without outside of the, you know, just sort of food and clothing, that type of thing? Something that has been a momental part of your journey?
Well, the obvious things for us are our computers and our cameras. I mean, those are our tools that we use to make films. But we've worked very hard to even simplify that, to say, okay, well, what can we get by with to do our work and still, you know, do good quality work, but yet keep our equipment and tools to a minimum. And that was put to the test about 2 weeks ago. I was invited to go to the Ivory Coast in Sub-Sahara Africa and film cacao farmers in the bush, and they don't have a thing called electricity. So we were challenged with the task of how do we film these people and do everything on batteries and do everything as minimally as possible, because we didn't want to carry a lot of things just because of the conditions and temperatures, and we were moving around a lot, you know, from one village to the next. It took a lot of work to prepare for that trip, to really refine and simplify and get down to the bare essentials, but still do the job in a professional way. I forgot the question. What was the question?
The question was, you know, looking at the limited number of things that you guys do have, were there things that that you could not sort of stay without, or are the most sort of value to you now that, you know, you've already simplified your life to a degree? And I think you did kind of cover it. And I guess there was one other thing before I turn it back over to Rahul, I wanted to ask, because you've talked about this book that led you to you know, look at greed and simplifying your life. And then I know that there was a film that you did as well, or, you know, for a part of, not a film, but an exhibit that you guys did on impermanence. And there's this, it just comes back to this sort of central Buddhist concept. I don't know if you want to take this or Heejin as well, just sort of what's the role of Buddhism been, or sort of how was it become sort of these sort of Buddhist values have become a part of your journey in your lives?
So the question is it pertaining to the project Impermanence, or?
Just, yeah, in general, how is this influence, right? I mean, it laid its impact in impermanence. It's laid its impact just in the way that you guys are living your lives by simplifying. You know, where did this influence sort of come from?
Well, I think it comes from a lot of places, but I think it comes from our concern, you know, going back to, you know, as we move forward as a civilization, you know, simplicity is a relative question, because in Côte d'Ivoire, the places we were in Africa, when I look at their lives, they had simple lives. You know, they didn't have 937 objects. They had three things or four things. So it's a relative term. And I think in the modern world for us, you know, as we move forward, I think we wanted to set an example and also prove to ourselves that it was possible to live simply and not have to be a consumer. You know, I mean, we're all consumers in some form, but not have that be sort of what rules our lives. We wanted our life and our work to be more about the stories we tell and the work we do. And I think that's the sort of essence of, you know, why we wanted to do that. Because it unencumbers you or enables you to do things that...
So one thing I wanted to throw in along those lines, and this is perhaps for Heejin, you know, I wanted to understand a little bit more about the dynamics between you and David as you work towards this experiment in simplicity. I know that, like, when I try and I know that it's an interesting process to get two people on the same page of values and actively working towards that. So I wanted to hear a little bit more about how you processed that journey also. And if it was kind of parallel insights that were occurring for you, or if it was a process of letting go, just what that looked like for you, Heejin.
Well, we've been working together for about 13 years now. And I think that helps a little bit because you learn each other's techniques and style. And both David and I have very similar design style, meaning aesthetic design style. So we seem to agree most of what each other's propose. So when we work together, usually one of us will come up with some kind of aesthetic style and the other will have another input and add value to it. So that's how we kind of process our concept together.
Mm-hmm.
And in editing, when we do films, we try to get down to the core essence of the story. And usually I take a pass, and then David takes a second pass, and then we do it together, the final pass, to get down to really, really essential, short, sweet message that connects with others.
Mm-hmm. I know when you're a filmmaker, you do get a chance to meet a lot of amazing people and to connect with them. So, Heejin, I wanted to hear about a moment or a person on camera that really blew you away. And then I want to hear, David, if you can answer the same question after Heejin.
Well, there's been so many amazing people that we interviewed so far. One of them that stands out and I always had in my back pocket is this Trappist monk that we interviewed for our Impermanence project. And he tells us a Trappist monk.
Trappist monk.
And,
okay.
He told us a story about a beggar who has his hand open for a dime, a quarter. And as soon as the hand is filled with a dime or something, your instinct is to close the hand and hold on to it. But if you are not, if you're holding on to it and not opening for more coins or more things in life, then you're closing the other opportunities. So he kind of told us the story of having the hand open all the time for new things to come and new opportunities to happen. And that story always, it always somehow applies to everything we do. You know, either it's in a film or it's practical issues in our life. Always have the hand open, your heart open. And it's been a very helpful tool or a story to remember.
Mm. David, how about you? What is a moment or an interview that's blown you away?
Well, like Heejin said, it's very hard because we've interviewed, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of people. A couple that stick out, I guess, in thinking about it. One was Sam Keen. I don't know if you know who he is. He's a writer, a philosopher. I think one of the books that probably made him more well known was called Fire in the Belly. It was written probably in the mid 80s. But Sam talked about one of his teachers. And I just remember him telling the story. As a matter of fact, it's something that you can see in about 2 weeks. We're going to be uploading a series of the project is called Legacy, and the subject is about what do you leave behind. And so we interviewed 26 people, I think. And we ended up only using 12 of them, and these are sort of notable folks who have done things in the world and who have left or who will leave or who are, I think, have interesting legacies already. But they talk about legacy. And Sam talks about a teacher he had who he was a well-known philosopher, and I can't think of his name right now. But he said, Sam repeats this teacher's quote to him, or I should say, lesson to him. And he said, Sam, there's two things in a man's life that he has to remember. The first thing is, where do you want to go? And the second question is, who do you want to take with you? And if you get those in the wrong order, you're in big trouble. And just the way he told that story, I'm doing a very poor job of it, but it just always stuck with me. I think it's an interesting question. You know, where do you want to go and who do you want to bring with you? And the fact that the order is important sort of left me with a question that I think about often. You know, where am I going and who am I going with? So philosophically, it's a...
How do you answer that? Where are you going and who are you taking with you?
I'm not sure. I don't know. Some days. And other days I do. I mean, I feel like certainly I'm on a journey with Heejin, but I'm also on the journey with a host of other people that come into my life, come in and out of my life. And you know, where? I don't know. I mean, I think for both of us, I think it's about, you know, our legacy is going to be about the stories that we leave behind, I think.
David, Heejin, I just wanted to kind of jump in here at this point because it was interesting that you just said that, you know, this is also a journey about the two of you together. And it was funny, I was having a conversation with my sister this morning and I was telling her about the call. And she was saying that she was amazed, like, wow, the husband and I, so they're married and they work together, so they're together all the time. And it just kind of blew her away for a minute. And I guess, you know, thinking about this journey, what would you say is one thing that you've really learned from one another? So maybe, Heejin, maybe something that you learned from David, and then vice versa, whether it was about yourself or just in general.
Well, I think we're still learning and continue to do so. David has a really good way of seeing big things. So I learned from him how to see in bigger picture, because I seem to be focused in one little thing or get stuck in details, like sometimes designers do. But he has this mind of covering the whole picture, which has been really helpful for me to think wider, bigger, and see the other opportunities far beyond, and that's something that he inspired me to do so continuously.
And how about you, David?
Well, I do think about things in a larger view sometimes. And I think also Heechin sort of reels me back in and says, no, we need to get this done today, and this project is due tomorrow morning, so get to work. so her practicality is very useful, but at the same time, we both go out there into the unknown of ideas and probe those things together. And I think it's really for both of us. I think it's about asking questions constantly and being willing to be open to not knowing. And I think that's one of the things that we both enjoy, and I think we share in our philosophy about living and working together. So it makes it pretty easy to be together in that sense. I think we just share that view that neither one of us have the answers, and we're always, like Heechin described the story about the beggar with the open hand. That's something I think we try to do, and sometimes that hand closes, and we remind each other, okay, open the hand. So that's very useful. And
so before we open it up to the broader group for Q&A, I'll ask sort of one last question. So in the service-based ecosystem, we often talk about the importance of stories, and I think we all have a very strong sense of how the stories that we share really catalyze other people's journeys, along with adding more momentum to our own. And yet we live in a society where there seems to be so many, we seem to perhaps have latched onto the wrong story, perhaps going in the wrong direction, and we seem to be repeating memes that aren't necessarily helpful for the larger direction we'd want to go in. So I wanted to hear a little bit more about your reflections on storytelling and its role in society, and particularly the role of media, whether you sort of share that opinion or have deeper insights. And maybe we can start with Heechin, and then, David, I'd love to hear your thoughts as well.
And while that's happening, if people have questions, the queue is on, so you can hit *6 to get in the queue. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I think the role of media, the film, is a powerful media. It started with myself when I was connected with it right away when I was practicing design, and I saw the potential of how powerful it can be as a storytelling this tool. So I just felt right to dive into this media and to tell a powerful story. That's another thing. You have to put a lot of hours into editing and get down to the core story. And our aesthetic has been always the simple and clean and honest way of telling the story. So I believe in listening. When you listen to the interviews and you are really being present with what they're saying and try to get to the true message within that present moment, and put into the tool, the film media, that becomes viral marketing almost. It spreads so fast when it's a good story, a story that you connect with.
Mm. David, how about you?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question because it's an evolving, you know, in the last, really in the last 10 or 15 years, even less, you know, the tools to be able to put stories out in the world have changed so dramatically. You know, things like cameras and YouTube, the internet, all of these things that are enablers have completely changed how people express their ideas and views. And it continues, I think we've only seen the tip of the iceberg here. You know, Marshall McLuhan talked about the medium is the message. Well, today I think the message is the message. You know, it really is about the story. It really is about
That's great. I'm going to turn it over to one of our callers so that we can get some of our questions in. And again, for those of you that are on the call, please push *6, and that way that you can jump into the queue. And so, Prakash?
Okay. You?
Thank you so much, David, Heejin. The simplicity, clarity, and the uncluttered cleanliness. I know those are not just the, you know, the beautiful tools to make a powerful video. It seems almost like those are the means to make a beautiful, the means for art of living.
Good morning. This is Pallavi from San Jose. Thank you for this wonderful space. David and Heejin and Rahul and Amit for the for leading the conversation. I wanted to ask you both about your process of creativity, and as I assimilate this conversation, I see you've kind of answered it. You talk about being in the space of the unknown, being present, and being open. But I would like to know if you could go deeper than that. For instance, how do you channel your muse? You know, is that something you even think about, or does it flow? And how does, you know, both of you working together change that process? And as an example, if you could share, like, you know, any kind of an intense creative block you've had and how you have gone past it, I would be really curious in learning more about that. Thank you.
Well, I think we can start with the project Impermanence. When we were asked to do this project for Missing Piece, we didn't know what we were going to do. We happened to be at the ceremony where the monks, the Tibetan monks, came to Half Moon Bay and had a ceremony and built this beautiful sun mandala and had a disbursement ceremony afterwards. We were so taken by their action, their love and passion of creating this, and then just in the end, giving away to everybody, being impermanent. We wanted to explore the topic of impermanence, and David instantly suggested, let's ask people, our friends and neighbors, about the topic of impermanence, what it means to them. So it just happened organically of asking questions. We didn't plan anything, we didn't have a vision, we just wanted to explore what topic of impermanence meant to other people, because we ourselves were so taken by it. And gradually the project became much bigger because the answers we got were so much profound and meaningful that we wanted to explore more. And we asked 122 people about the topic of impermanence, and that became our installation, our artistic installation, the voices of 122 people talking about impermanence.
Yeah, so I think, you know, also to answer the question, I'm not exactly sure where our you know, the core of creativity comes from, or I don't know that I really understand that, but I do think that really emphasizing that being open to new possibilities, as Heejin described, you know, we had no idea when we started that project where it would go or where it would land. All we knew was we wanted to do something that related to. We were asked to join it's called The Missing Piece, and it was a artistic exhibition that was really that expressed the views of the Dalai Lama in terms of, well, in relation to peace and living a peaceful life, and we felt, you know, impermanence was an area that enabled that peacefulness. So, I mean, I don't think we really knew how to get there, but we were willing to, I guess, open our minds and our hearts up to, again, listening. And it evolved into quite an interesting project that became a book. It became an installation that traveled for 6 years around the world. That we had no idea it would you know, evolve into that.
But we always have back in our mind why this a topic or the film we design or create. Why would it matter to us? We start there, and then we start with others. Why would it matter to other people? And I think that helps us to kind of guide us creating a film that matters.
This is Rahul again. Before we go on to the next question, I just wanted to reemphasize the other part of Pallavi's question, which was I was really interested in hearing about whether you've had any creative blocks, what those have been, and how you've overcome those.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have creative blocks pretty much daily. It's just part of the territory in the sense of we kind of never know what the answer to the question is. And a lot of time it just evolves and it just happens. I mean, it's kind of a hard question to answer because I think we come at this work fairly intuitively and instinctually. I don't know. I think when we do get stuck, we talk about things together. You know, we'll say, okay, well, let's sleep on this and wake up in the morning and come at it fresh. And sometimes we have an answer and sometimes we need to let it percolate some more. So it's never the same, but somehow we managed to get to an answer most of the time. Mm-hmm. And if we don't, sometimes we let it rest and come back to it.
It sounds like actually a bit of a challenging process. I mean, to hear about creative blocks happening every day. So I'm also, before we go to the next question, I just also want to hear a little bit more about what keeps you going and keeps you charged up in the face of something that I think many people may feel is quite daunting, right? If you're so deeply in the present, presence of a question that you don't know the answer to, the uncertainty alone can sometimes be a lot for many people to handle. So, Heejin, how do you deal with that, the persistent sort of blockage or and overcoming a blockage or the persistence needed to sort of stare those down?
Well, I think it's like when you live every day today, it's there's so many distractions, and trying to stay focused is kind of practicing being present and not be distracted with other things. And blockage is kind of like, you know, how do I stay focused but get inspired at the same time? It's a practice, and it's hard to answer, I guess.
You know, it's funny you asked that question. We came to Nipun's parents' house and had the pleasure of meeting
Deepak Chopra.
Deepak. One of the things that, you know, if you were there, I think you probably heard, you know, he talked about uncertainty. And I really enjoyed his answer because he, I think, simply posed the same question. And he said, I wake up every day and hope that today will be more uncertain than the day before. And for me, that was a wonderful answer, because in a way, it opens up the world of possibility. I think, if you think you know the answer, then you've closed the door.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've put that thing aside and said, well, okay, I know the answer to that, I'm done. And I think one of the joys for us is not knowing the answer and, waking up every day with a question. So it keeps our relationship fresh, and it keeps us engaged, with each other, in the sense of, there's always work to do. And I think that's, stimulating and challenging and fun, and it really is the fuel.
Yeah, it's a daily challenge for us, I think, not knowing what tomorrow's going to look like and what we're creating.
Wonderful. I'll open to the next question. And for those still on the queue, you want to press *6 to get in the queue. We'll move on to the next question.
Hi, this is Netika. I'm calling from Los Angeles. Thank you again, Service Space, Amit, and Rahul, and everybody on the call and your presence. The space is opens up a lot of insights. And thank you, David and Heejin, for your presence and for your personal story as you embark on this journey of sharing other stories. I think a lot of things resonated, your journey for decluttering and less of consumerism, more of simplicity. So I thank you for your presence. A couple of questions, two specifically. One is, most of, the other designers that I've come across have moved from industrial design and, corporate products to what is kind of referred to as designing for affordability, or designing for the other 90%. And I'm wondering if ever you guys had looked into that, or actively decided not to pursue it in favor of storytelling. And the second question is really around, in your about your inner journeys. From whatever I've heard from both of you on this call, it's really come through very clearly that whatever's manifested in your films and the subject matters that you choose and the topics, it's really about where you are in your inner journey. And so the question is that on one hand, I'm hearing, you know, the value for, on the recognition for impermanence, and also a quest for leaving a legacy. And I'm wondering if you could reflect on that and share how you're resolving those two.
So,
thank you.
The first question, let me just make sure I understand the questions. First question is about whether we still participate in design and engage in activities that have to do with creating products for really the rest of the world, you know, not necessarily the sort of consumer type products that exist today. Okay. So to the first question, now we have made a choice to really not engage in design activities and really focus our attention to storytelling. For a while we were kind of doing a little bit of both early on in our sort of film careers, but I think we discovered quickly that it's pretty hard to do both. I mean, we certainly have a an active engagement with some of the design community, just because that's a group of people we know and have worked with. But I think really our focus is really about storytelling. So I think we can only do so much, and that seems to be consuming most of our time.
However,
yeah,
we keep designing homes, and I think that's where our design background kind of keeps alive. We built and designed our homes last 12 years, and that seemed to be continued with our film working. Yeah.
Yeah, we definitely have a love for architecture and creating places or spaces, and that seems to somehow continue. We've been asked by friends to design homes for them, and we do that occasionally.
Mm.
But it's really a secondary, secondary to our storytelling. That is our primary activity.
Mm. Okay.
Great. You know, like I said, we've just run up on our sort of 90-minute time. Do you guys have time for one more question, and then we'll close out?
Sure.
Great. Okay. Bill?
Oh, good. It's Bill Miller. Hi, David. Hi, Jen. I guess I get the final question. Wondering if it's possible to summarize your guiding philosophy down to maybe like a simple soundbite. You know, is there a particular thing that you're trying to accomplish or to contribute to the world? Or I guess the last caller or questioner talked about it as a legacy.
Well, I think whatever we tell, we try to, our legacy maybe is, you know, try to tell a story that connects, that lasts, that could have a meaning and joy, where if it's just for the moment or for more longer time. I think that's kind of like our philosophy of telling our stories.
Mm. And I think also I really enjoy is the work that we do, the artistic work that we do. Sometimes it's visually based, sometimes it's story based. And I hope those things will exist as a sort of milestone for you know, our explorations in time. It'll be interesting to see what of those things survive and what don't. I don't know. I don't really think much about leaving a legacy. I don't. That's not a concern, really. It's. I think that'll be determined by other people later on. They'll either look at our work and say, "Oh, that was good or bad or not." That's not something I really worry about.
Yeah. So you don't have a sort of a mission statement, huh?
Well, I think we have a mission statement, but in a different form. Is really, you know, again, we have interest in I guess I'd say things that are centered around social issues, social questions, how do people live in the world, and how can you get people to think about those issues? So that's I don't know if that's a very good mission statement, but it's really
sounds
about
like one to me. Thanks. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's really about asking questions and about sort of uncovering ideas and truths about living.
Well, David, Heejin, on behalf of everyone on the call, truly wanted to thank you for giving us your time and sharing what you guys have did. I mean, there were a lot of beautiful things that you've given us a legacy, in a sense, to that we can even just take away in our own lives, whether it was the story of the Trappist monk, which I know that you keep that in your back pocket, Heejin, but I think I'm going to start keeping that in mind as well. It's a very sort of telling story. And then just from your own personal journeys, whether it's, you know, unblocking to unleash that creativity, living with simplicity, and, you know, reading something and appreciating it, but then actually incorporating that into your own lives. And so just really beautiful to see that, and really the work that you guys are all doing. And, you know, as a follow-up to the call, we will sort of send out links so that people can really see some of the work that you guys have done and continue to do. And very, very much appreciative of you guys being sort of part of the service space ecosystem. And so sort of with that said, just wanted to close out with the final minute, just do a minute of gratitude and silence. And then I'm going to unmute the call and we can just sort of do a collective thank you. And so a minute of silence, please, and gratitude. I'm just going to click off mute here in a second, and then on the count of three, I'd love to hear just kind of a big, warm, collective thank you to David and Heejin for your time. So on the count of three, one, two, and three.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Happy weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.